The next case this morning is number 04-1389, the United States against Stephen Butler.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Kirk O'Bare. I represent the defendant appellant Stephen Dale Butler. I was also trial counsel at the district court level. The essential issue in this case is a fairly narrow one. It comes down to whether or not the district court committed error in the process of finding that Mr. Butler's possession of a firearm was in connection with another felony offense by applying the guidelines provision found at 2K2.1B5. The only evidence cited by the court really in relation to this connection between the possession of the firearm and the other felony offense that may have been committed was the physical location of the firearm. And to summarize the facts that related to that determination, Mr. Butler was the subject, or his home was the subject of a search warrant based upon the finding of vegetable matter, marijuana stalks basically, in the trash a couple of days prior to the issuance of the search warrant. There was marijuana found throughout the house and specifically in a locked safe that was an unloaded Jennings 22 handgun. Along with that handgun, there was a small amount of marijuana, approximately 20 grams of marijuana, and a scale. There were also some expired identification cards that belonged to Mr. Butler. Essentially, the court conducted a fairly thorough review on the issue of whether or not another felony offense was committed, but then after concluding that, in fact, another felony offense, either manufacturing of marijuana or possession with intent to distribute marijuana, whatever the case may be, there was a finding that there was, in fact, some other felony being committed, but the court ended its analysis there, simply pointing out that the proximity of the weapon being found along with some contraband drugs inside of a locked safe warranted the conclusion that it was possessed in relation to or in connection with another felony offense. The reason that we have, of course, as it's outlined in the briefs by both sides, the term in connection with has not been thoroughly addressed by the Guidelines Commission. And there is no specific definition or guidance within the guidelines that reflects how the term in connection with should be used. There is, however, language borrowed from some of the other provisions, and specifically all of the circuits, including this circuit, of course, have approved the usage of the in relation to language that comes from Title 18, United States Code, Section 924C1. And the courts have all found that there is no material difference between those two sets of terms. In connection with then means precisely the same thing as in relation to. And I'd point out that the case law that deals with this subject is very clear on the fact that there must in fact be some relationship between the possession of the firearm and the felony activity that's being conducted. Not surprisingly, many of these cases arise in the context of drug possession, drug distribution, or in this case, an element of drug manufacturing as well. Now, there's also some language that was addressed by the court and was addressed by both sides at the sentencing hearing that relates to the significance of physical proximity. And that comes from some language that's in
Ewing,
United States versus Ewing. And the important component of that is that there's this policy statement, more or less, that it can be viewed as strong evidence that the inference can be
powerful, I believe the word.
Powerful, yes, Your Honor. And I think what happened is the court simply cited that as some form of guidance in terms of whether
sounds good, though, doesn't it?
It does sound pretty powerful, I agree, Your Honor. But I think the point is that given the absence of an actual connection in this case and the absence of any evidence or even the district court identifying where that connection may lie, it would appear that any time there are weapons found in proximity to drugs, we would automatically have a four-level...
The same safe.
Well, certainly.
With drug paraphernalia. Safe was locked, wasn't it?
It was locked. Yes, Your Honor. Now, that brings up, I think before I get on to some of the facts that are elaborated in some of the other cases, I did want to comment on the standard of review. There was a more recent case that I analyzed, quite honestly, after I had submitted my brief. It was a 2004 Seventh Circuit case that actually does not interpret 2K2.1B5, but actually relates to 2B1.1B7C, an entirely different application of the guidelines. But the important issue in United States versus Wallace is that, in that case, it had to do with whether or not a defendant had been sufficiently warned, so to speak, by action of an administrative agency that his actions were unlawful, and it was basically they had issued a letter in the Wallace case. And the question was whether or not that had been a prior specific judicial or administrative order, injunction, decree, or process, which warrants a two-level enhancement in the type of case where a person engages in further criminal conduct after having been officially warned, so to speak. The reason that's an important case is that the court examined the interpretation of that particular language, and specifically what constitutes a prior specific judicial or administrative order and so forth. And really, that it calls for a de novo review when there's an actual interpretation of a guidelines provision. And I think that's really what this case is about, is the interpretation of what in connection with under 2K2.1B5 means, and if the court, the district court, had properly interpreted that language. So I do think a de novo review is called for here. I am aware, and in candor to the court, in reviewing this matter, there is commentary, I believe, in the Haynes case, which is a 1999 case that does deal with a 2K2.1B5 type enhancement, where it was treated as a mixed issue of fact and law. And in Haynes, the court commented that the factual portion, of course, would be reviewed for clear error, but the interpretation of the in connection with or in relation to language would call for a de novo review. The interesting thing about the cases that have interpreted whether or not this four-level enhancement should apply, and I would concede that every case from this circuit has applied that four-level enhancement. That is true. But there is, in every one of those cases, a very careful analysis as to what causal or logical relation there is between the actual possession of the firearm and what was occurring in the case. We start out by looking at, and I'll just go through them briefly, the Patterson case from 1996, the Wyatt case from 1996, the Ewing case from 1992, the Morris case from 2003, and the Haynes case from 1994. In each one of those cases, there were specific facts that the district court drew out and found on the record that made it so that the possession was a component of criminal conduct, and there was very clear evidence of that in each case. In some cases, this issue was raised even when a person was carrying a firearm on their person while committing a drug deal, and then the issue came up as to how the person came into possession of it and whether they intended and so on and so forth, which really has nothing to do with this case. But very quickly, the Patterson case, the defendant had a duffel bag in the trunk of his car that also contained a weapon and some drugs, and it was obviously a very portable type situation. He was using the weapon as part of his drug trafficking, so to speak. In the Wyatt case, the weapons were stored close to a doorway, were loaded. One of them was a sawed-off gun, and there were silencers. The guns were equipped with silencers. And the proximity and location of these things, it was easy to envision that they would be used to protect the premises as a drug-dealing type place, because they were readily accessible, loaded, and because they were close to a doorway was very significant in that case. In the Ewing case, which the government has pointed out, I believe in its brief and also at the sentencing hearing, that because it was in a locked box, it's somehow analogous to this case. But I'd point out that it was a portable strong box that also contained the defendant's current identification and other things that had been used recently, along with drugs and so on. The Morris case, the individual actually admitted that he was using the weapon for protection while he was dealing drugs or selling drugs. And finally, in the Haynes case, the accessibility of the weapon, this person actually brandished the weapon while in the middle of a drug sale. And in all of these cases, it's quite clear that there is this nexus And it's absent on the record in this case. I realize I have very little time left. I reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roker. We'll hear now from
Ms. Watzka, Your Honor.
Ms. Watzka.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Kelly Watzka. I represent the United States in this matter. I'd like to begin first with the standard of review argument because I think it controls in this matter. It's my position that the Wallace case is really inapplicable. The defendant has argued that because this case involves the interpretation of a sentencing guideline, that necessitates de novo review. But a closer look at the defendant's arguments in his brief, and in fact listening to his arguments here today, reveals that that is really not the case. The defendant is not arguing that the district court misunderstood Section 2K2.151B5, nor has he argued that the district court misconstrued the meaning of the phrase in connection with, as that term has been defined by this court. Instead, all of the defendant's arguments are fact-based. He argues about whether or not there was sufficient evidence from which the district court could conclude that the defendant in this case possessed a firearm in connection with marijuana trafficking. Because he does not take issue with the district court's understanding of the guideline, the applicable guideline, or the relevant case law, clear error is the appropriate standard of review. And I note, Judge Ripple, as you stated earlier this morning in a case that was before the court, the world turns on standards of review. What that means in this case is that as long as Judge Griesbach's interpretation of the evidence was permissible, it frankly does not matter whether the defendant or even this court would reach a different, perhaps equally plausible conclusion. And in this case, the review of the record leaves little doubt that it was perfectly permissible for Judge Griesbach to have concluded not only that the defendant engaged in marijuana trafficking, but that his possession of the firearm at issue in this case was used in connection with that drug trafficking offense. I will admit that the bulk of the argument at the sentencing hearing and the bulk of, I believe, Judge Griesbach's comments at the sentencing hearing addressed whether or not the defendant was engaged in marijuana trafficking. There was an argument made by the defendant that the manufacturing of this marijuana was simply for personal use. The government, of course, argued that it was evidence of trafficking, and that was hotly disputed at the hearing. And so the bulk of the fact finding that was done at the hearing did focus on that issue. And those facts include the presence of marijuana along with the scale, the fact that the marijuana was separately packaged. There was a larger gallon-sized bag of marijuana and then smaller containers of smaller quantities of marijuana. Information provided by a confidential informant that there had been a large amount of traffic to and from this residence. The defendant's own prior conviction for dealing drugs from that same residence. The fact that the garbage search that was executed at the home revealed stocks, which the government's expert opined would have yielded a certain quantity of marijuana. And the fact that there was a huge disparity in terms of the amount of marijuana actually recovered a short time later in the residence. All of these facts related to whether or not there was trafficking as opposed to personal use going on, and that's the bulk of the testimony, or the argument, and the court's finding. But there were also facts, an argument about whether or not, what the relationship was with the gun and this marijuana and the drug paraphernalia. And the judge very definitely relied heavily on the Ewing case and its guidance that close proximity of a firearm to drugs or drug paraphernalia is powerful support for an inference that those two things are related. And that certainly was the primary basis for the court's decision in this case. I would suggest to the court that the cases relied upon by the government, and in fact the defendant, in particular the Patterson case, suggests that that close proximity may be enough in most circumstances to establish that connection. But that wasn't all that was present in this case. I argued at the sentencing hearing that the defendant had other weapons in this very small residence. It was a motorhome. The defendant had two BB guns, and he had an antique powder pistol. Those weapons were not stored.
You know what?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What was the last weapon?
An antique powder pistol.
Antique powder pistol.
An old-fashioned gun.
One you poured the powder in, rammed it in or something.
That's right, Your Honor.
Was it functional?
You know, I don't know if it was functional, and I apologize, I can't answer that. It may have been, it may not have been. But what's important, and what I argued at the sentencing hearing, is that those weapons were not kept in the safe with the scale and the marijuana and the defendant's personal belongings. They were stored elsewhere in the home. And it was reasonable for the district court to conclude, based on that fact, that the semi-automatic pistol was in that safe for a reason. And the reason was to protect the defendant's stash of marijuana and his other drug paraphernalia. That was a perfectly permissible, and I would argue, the only reasonable conclusion in this case for Judge Griesbach to have made. The fact that the defendant has an argument to the contrary is really irrelevant under the clear air standard. And for all of these reasons, unless the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I will rest on my brief and simply ask the court to sustain Judge Griesbach's determination.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Martin.
You, Your Honor.
We'll give you 1 minute, sir.
Thank you very much. Your Honor, let me please the court. Obviously, if counsel for the appellate defendant is arguing for a de novo review, the facts are important because this court then has to examine the facts and determine whether or not the district court has made a proper interpretation of the applicable guideline provision. So I think the fact that our brief and our argument today before the Seventh Circuit focuses on many of the facts is not surprising. But really what it comes down to is whether or not this particular guideline enhancement driving up Mr. Butler's sentence an entire four levels is appropriate based upon the evidence that was on record at the time. Now, the fact that the Ewing case calls for, or at least gives us guidance, that the close proximity of a weapon to drugs gives us powerful support, it does not equal a mandatory requirement that the, and it certainly contemplates that there will be situations where drugs can be in proximity to the weapons and not necessarily call for it. The court didn't articulate why there was the application of this particular enhancement. And again, this is a case that does not demonstrate facts wherein there is any evidence that it was actually assisted the defendant in any way, and the government had just made a comment in closing here that it was obviously for the purpose of protecting a stash, but the court's also aware of the fact that the stash was spread throughout the entire apartment and it was an unloaded gun in a locked safe.
I think we have the point, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also thank you, Mr. O'Bear, for having taken the appointment in this case and for the fine work you have done on behalf of your client in that appointment. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel in the case, and we will be taken under advisement. The court has finished the call of the morning, and so the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow.